there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 333. That sounds like a lucky number to me. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line. Send an email on over to ken@thisshowissogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowissogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. The handle is thisshowissogay. And of course, go on over to that Facebook. Type in This Show Is So Gay. Like us, because we sure as heck like you. We have such an amazing show for you this week. We must get started with our guest. Lady Dane Figueroa Adidi is an African-Cuban Native American trans performance artist, author, teacher, choreographer, healer, advocate, blogger, an ancient jazz priestess of Mother Africa, and so much more, although I don't even think there are more things than that. Lady Dane made her cabaret debut at the age of 17, and 2011 made her debut in New York. Lady Dane is a passionate actor. She has worked at such theaters as the Roundhouse Theater, the Kennedy Center, the Theater for the New City, Arena Stage, Adventure Theater, Atlas Theater, and the Spooky Action Theater, which sounds exciting. In December of 2013, Lady Dane became the first trans woman of color author in DC to publish a novel of fiction. It was called Yemaya's Daughters, and in that text, the main protagonist was a trans woman. In 2015, she received the Pioneer Award for her work with the DC trans community, and she was honored as one of the Trans 100. Also in 2015, she made history again as the first trans playwright whose work is a part of Theater Alliance's Hot House New Play Reading Series. And if I keep listing accomplishments, we will have no time to actually speak, so let's leave it there and just say, Lady Dane, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Hi, Ken.
We have no time left, because look at all of that.
It's so, you know, it's so interesting is that, like, sometimes I wake up and I'm like, I have to do more things. Right? And then, like, you read all these things that are pretty awesome. It's pretty awesome.
I'm happy to hear that you woke up, because that implies to me that you're sleeping, because that's one of the things that I'm worried about.
You know what? It's so weird, but, like, the last 2 months, I've had a little bit of bout of insomnia, and I used to actually apprentice under an herbalist for about 5 years, and she taught me so many things about, like, the herbs and what teas to make for a sleep potion. It's just, like, so much has been going on in my brain lately, and I just released another novella, another book, and I've been so worried about my deadline for that. I set my own deadlines, but I also announced it 2 months ago, and I was like, oh, I need my deadline to be met, so. But I slept through the night last night. Hey.
Nice. I love it. I love it. Well, let's start here. Let's just talk about 2015. This had to have been quite a year for you.
It was, you know, it was so interesting, and I was kind of talking about this. I'm also outside on the streets of D.C. at a coffee shop, but I was just talking about 2014, you know, because I made history actually in 2013 with Yemaya's Daughters, and 2014 was a very difficult year for me.
Yeah.
It was a very painful year, and I really relied on my community and my mom and my sister, Lovey, and, you know, my social justice mother, Ruby, to really get me through that year. It was a very, very difficult year, and so 2015 has seen all of these amazing things happening for me, and it has been much better, and I'm really honored that the universe chose to engage my prayers and my pleas for some kind of relief. And it's only getting better and better.
So. Oh, it's going to get even better. 2016, it's just going to be an hour of reading your accomplishments. I'm so excited. It's going to be great. It's going to be great. Now, at the start of your bio, I read so many different labels for you. Is there one word for you that encapsulates what it is that you put out into the world?
Goddess.
Nice. Goddess is a pretty amazing word. Talk to me about being a goddess. That's a lot for me.
So for me, I believe we're all divine beings, simply made flesh, right? And I also believe that our flesh is sacred. And so being a goddess, it means that I am doing what my ancestors did, which I am embodying the divine being that is me.
Yeah.
At every moment, of every day, of every second. And so, yeah, that's why it encapsulates. Yeah. It encompasses everything that I am, because, you know, all of those things that you read, the ancient jazz priestess, the singer, the dancer, the actress, all of those things are part of my divine being operating authentically in the world.
You know, we have so many guests on the show talking about their current projects and maybe projecting forward and talking about the future. And in looking at some of your work and kind of immersing myself in a little bit of your craft, it strikes me that in addition to the present and the future, you also seem to have a really strong connection with the past. Is that fair to say?
Yes. Oh, yes. Almost definitely. I mean, I am a priestess of the Lukumi. I'm a Lukumi priestess of Oya, and Oya is she's a goddess, but we call, you know, she's a goddess Orisha, an aspect of divine self, of the wind of change, of the ancestors. She's called the mother of the Egun, the mother of the spirit. And, you know, the ancestors and honoring the ancestors and honoring your elders was a central part of my growing up.
Yeah.
And a part of my spiritual identity. And so I also will say this, is that the way that structural oppression works is that it attempts to tell us that it attempts to erase us, right, completely. And where it starts actually is not simply with us living now. It starts with our past. It starts with those who have come before us. And so historically, not only have trans and gender nonconforming people of color been under attack by particularly colonization, but so have our histories. And so honoring our histories and maintaining our histories is very important to me, because if we can find ourselves in the past, we can find ourselves now. That's what I believe.
I want to take that even further. For our brothers and sisters out there who don't have that connection with the past, how would you recommend that they get started with that? Because you've laid out the case that how important it is, especially because there's so many forces at work trying to erase this history. But for those of our brothers and sisters who are trying to figure out, yeah, but I don't have that connection, I have no idea where to start, where would you recommend that they start?
With themselves.
Yeah. Yeah.
We are the proof of ancestor legacy. We are the proof. Our existence is divine, like, is divine purpose, like, made manifest in the flesh. And so for me, like, people say, where to start? And I say, did you wake up this morning? Are you breathing? Are you alive? Are you real?
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Are you real? And so we start with ourselves. And that's kind of what it was for me. I said, I must start with me. And my aunt, for example, gave, you know, she was the first curator of the Great Black Stone Wax Museum. So I grew up learning about the histories of black people pre-slavery. And we can have conversations about, you know, terminology and words and all these things. But if we're talking about the definition of a black person, I'm talking about the African from which we all sprang. And you know, I had to learn a lot, and what it did was that it engaged me, because I said, if I'm here now, that means that there were people who came before me. And so I say, start with you. If you're here, that means someone like you existed before you.
I love that. You know, I read in your bio the first trans person to do this, or the first trans woman of color to do that. What do those labels before the accomplishments mean to you?
You know, it's so funny, Gray, because, like, I, you know, some people say, like, I don't want any labels, and some people attempt to erase labels, but I think that where we are now, and as far as I feel inside of my own experience, is that labels can sometimes be political.
Yeah.
I was having this conversation with a good friend, and he was like, labels are political, and I was like, that's true. And so for me, it is about the fact of, I'm always big into language as well, and taking language and turning it into a weapon, turning it into a healing tool, turning it to a space, a living space. And so one of those things is identifying my womanhood being linked to my transness. It really, really, really does make a bold statement of how magical trans people are.
Yeah.
And I think that that is also the truth for other trans people and other people who choose to not consider themselves trans, but are, you know, but are people of color and doing magical things. And so for me, having those labels before my accomplishments, it really is also a marker for how I think how sad the world really is, because what seems to have happened is that, why am I the first trans woman of color in D.C.? to publish a work of fiction.
Right.
Right? Like, why is that? Why has that happened? And so that then leads me to go to publishing companies and say, why haven't you published someone before this? Or to other spaces and being like, why were we not there? And I know the answer, right? I'm asking the question, and then I also answer the question.
I'm all for that. That makes a radio guy's job so much easier. So do it. Yeah.
And so I get it. Like, I'm a historian as well, so I get the structural oppression that even creatives, right, even artists, even those in the theater community, those who create art, also have participated in this erasure of trans people.
Yeah. I would imagine that, particularly after you were listed on the Trans 100, that you heard from any number of people who said, and now you are paving the way for them.
You know, it's so funny because people do say that. And I'm always like, what?
Own it.
I think because for me, I am simply existing in my truth. And,
yeah.
And I have always wanted to create pathways for myself and for other people. And so, for example, a friend of mine and myself we're getting a paper published in an academic publication. And it's utilizing kind of my life story as a way to like engage how we can utilize music education.
Yeah.
And how we can teach trans children, how we can be a little more comprehensive and intersectional in our teaching of trans children within music education. And he had written something in the bio, and it was something along the lines of like, my voice is loud and I'm speaking for the community. And I said, I don't like that terminology, because I was like, I actually want to shift away from this idea of speaking for other people, right? Because that's actually not what I'm doing.
Right.
What I'm doing is creating pathways for myself and others.
It's such important work. Such important work. Well, we have so many different areas of your life to hit on. I'm just going to be a little bit random right now. Are you ready?
Okay.
Tell everybody, if they don't know, tell everybody who Diamond Malone is.
Oh, my God. Diamond Malone. So Diamond Malone. Oh, my God. So Diamond Malone is the main character in the musical that Andrew Morrissey and I have written called Roaring. Roaring is the first musical that we know of that basically is written by a trans woman of color, particularly a black trans woman. The concept is by a black trans woman that would star a black trans woman and about a black trans woman in the 1920s within Harlem.
Wow, look at that.
So Diamond Malone is the character that I created in 2001. When I saw that there was no trans woman of color representation on Broadway, and I mean, you know, let alone, you know, people were not giving us our due for writing our own stories. Right?
Oh, yeah.
So, I created this narrative about Diamond and her family in Harlem during the 1920s, particularly because the history of Harlem and the history of the black community within Harlem, which is, you know, we were having balls. We were embracing and loving our LGBTQ-ness at that time. And so for me, what I did was I did a lot of research on what it was like to be black in Harlem at that time, and then how could I imagine this trans woman existing in that space, because so much of the history is lost because people have had to hide
right.
who they were to thrive. And back then, often people didn't realize that people were, people didn't realize that people were trans until after they died.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Diamond Malone is kind of me putting us back at the center, which we were. We were. More and more information is actually coming out about trans women existing not only in the 20s, but also pre that.
Right.
You know, during slavery, it's incredible the stories that are out there, but that have been purposefully kept from us.
I would imagine working on such a project had to have affected you personally.
Oh my God. It completely, it changed my life.
Yeah.
For me, I, you know, right now we're still searching for funding. We want to get it produced, Andrew. And Andrew did the music. He's the composer. I did the book and the lyrics and the concept. And so we're still trying to find funding because we really wanted to go to Broadway. And not because we think that Broadway is this shining emerald city, to just quote the Wiz. I don't know if you've seen it recently, but.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Wiz was giving life. But But we do understand that, like, what Broadway will do is that it will allow for us to continue to engage the conversation in a way which is beneficial for trans actors, particularly trans actresses of color.
Yeah.
And so it really did change me. It changed my life. It changed my life because she herself is me. She's me if I was born back then, is what a friend, Lou Seamster, said to me. He played the first Tom, who's Diamond's brother, and he was like, well, Diamond is essentially you. And so what that means is that she's an amazing, amazing creative. She's called a star by some. She's cultivated by her mother to become a star. She's cultivated to essentially be the it girl. And creating her and playing her all these years has been an incredible healing tool for me and also for the ancestors.
Yeah.
Really telling the ancestors, like, you are remembered.
So important. So important. Now, we have talked about this group before on the show, but not in quite some time. For our listeners who don't know, tell everybody about the Trans Women of Color Collective.
Ah, the Trans Women of Color Collective is amazing, amazing, amazing. I'm excited to be a co-leader of the Trans Women of Color Collective along with our leadership team, you know, our national director, Lourdes Ashley Hunter and Katrina Goodland and Samantha Joe. We are the leadership team. And we are a collective of amazing trans and gender nonconforming people of color who have come together after the death of Elon Nettles. It was found, you know, TWOC was founded in New York. And we are centered around collective healing and liberation for all marginalized people. And we uplift the lived narrative of trans and gender nonconforming people of color. And it's just amazing. It is amazing being a part of this incredible collective. And we believe in the principles of cooperative economics, of liberation, of love, of fellowship, of creating liberation for all of us. So not just, you know, not just us, but also like our mamas.
Yeah, right?
You know,
yeah.
Our brothers and sisters, our siblings. So, yeah.
Oh, amazing group there. Again, listeners, we're here with Lady Dane Figueroa Adidi, goddess, author, teacher, performance artist. We had your colleague, Jay Mace III, on, gosh, it was almost a year ago, and we talked all about Awkward, which, for folks who don't know about Awkward, tell them about Awkward and what a great group that is.
So Awkward is amazing. It was founded by Jay Mace, and it's the first talent agency that is specifically designed for trans and gender nonconforming people of color and queer people of color. And so it specializes in getting us booked.
Yeah.
Because for so, you know, for so long, so many of us have heard, you know, oh, I couldn't find anybody. I couldn't, you know, people have said, I couldn't find anybody, right? And so now I'm like, well, Awkward exists, and Awkward has a whole roster of people. So
it's an amazing roster.
It's the first of its kind, and it has some amazing talent on it. So,
Including you. Including you, amazing talent there.
Including me.
One more piece of your life, and there's so many others. Talk to us. You're a regular contributor to Queer of Gender, which I was checking out. That's an amazing group of writing.
Yeah, so unfortunately, I haven't been able to contribute in a while because of my, just how busy my schedule has been. And also trying to survive, right? Like, literally just trying to get booked so I can eat and I can live. Because
right.
I think that sometimes what happens is that people see our existence in this way of like, oh, well, she's on this cover of this, or she's doing this, or she's doing this. But this summer was very difficult for me because there weren't as many bookings. And so I was like, I need to get my bookings up. And so there would be times that I'm like, I'm going to pay my bills, right? And so for me, like, this summer was really, really, really about producing my own content, in the sense that Brew came out this summer, and then so did Baltimore Love Letter, and then Wither just came out. And so along with my touring schedule and everything else that I had going on, and my auditions, right? Like I'm an actress too, and
yeah.
I'm still auditioning and creating and being a part of Theater Alliance's Hot House new play reading series. I was just so busy and I just didn't have the time to really cultivate and articulate the ideas within an article form that I wanted to, and I think that's fine, right? That is
oh my gosh,
because,
yeah.
life is life, but Queer of Gender is amazing. It is specifically designed for queer and trans gender nonconforming people of color, and it uplifts our narrative. It's in our own voices. And so it comes out of Canada. It was started by my good friend Lynx. And so I'm very honored to be a part of that movement as well.
Oh, it's so great. Now, we talk so much about allyship on this show, and I always love to get our guest take on, all right, if you had that magic wand, Lady Dane, what spell would you cast? And by the way, I think you probably could do it as a goddess. What spell would you cast to change some minds, to increase allyship for trans women of color out there?
Well, first I will say this. I want to shift the narrative, right? I want to shift the language. I'm going to shift the language, allyship, to one of solidarity.
Yes.
And camaraderie, right? And this is what we do at our Trans Women of Color Collective, is that we shift the narrative from allyship to camaraderie, because we're all being affected
right.
in some way by structural oppression. It's just that the positionality is different. And so for me, I think, like, this word ally is so loaded with so much toxic history.
Oh, yeah.
Particularly because, like, in the past, this idea of ally is, like, let me speak for you. I'll take all the credit. I'll take all the money. And I'll give you the scrap.
No, I don't like that.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's kind of what the history of allyship has looked like. And it has kind of been a history of disenfranchisement and depowering trans and queer people. Particularly of color. And so for me, I like camaraderie. I like thinking of this as a battle that we're all a part of.
Yeah.
And that, you know, if one of us is not free, then none of us is free.
Right. Right.
And so what would I say, you know, what would I say to them to increase awareness? I want to be honest with you, Ken.
Do it.
I'm learning that all I can do in my life is exist, tell the stories that are truthful, be who I am. All I can do is truly be who I am, do the work that I do. And I'm shifting into this idea of I play with those who play with me. I stand in solidarity with those who stand in solidarity with me. And if you want me to come and get your business together, to make your business a little more trans-friendly, or to exist in a space that is beneficial and where trans people can thrive in leadership, then you have to pay me to come do that. You have
right.
to pay me to come to your cis organization and to help to create a blueprint. Because I also think that places like Casa Ruby and TWOC have created the blueprint already.
Yeah.
And what that is, right, is that is trans and gender nonconforming people leading, being leaders. And we have been leading from the very beginning. And so... I don't know what I would say. I think that I am constantly engaging, shifting the narrative, but that starts all with me, right? And that starts with the way that I navigate and me understanding that I am a leader and that I do not need the validation of cis people or, you know, cis het people. I don't need their validation. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think that piece about the positions of leadership is such a salient point. And I've just been thinking about this more and more because you have all of our national LGBT organizations out there and the heads of almost all of them are white cisgender men. And so where is the space for those voices to be heard?
Well, I will say this. There are those of us who want to dismantle the system.
Yes.
And there are those of us who want to uphold the system and just change our positionality within it. And so in order to sometimes change your positionality within the system, you have to be willing to throw some people under the bus. And so what I'm finding is that some of those white, cis, gay men are, they are existing from a place of trauma and a place of respectability politics.
Yeah.
And tokenization.
Yeah.
And so what that means is that if they're willing to tokenize themselves and to get funding and not really do the work that they have said that they're supposed to do, then they're not going to be about liberation. And I think that what we need is we need liberation. And how that happens is that you put trans people with amazing analysis about dismantling the system and process in places of leadership. And you pay them a living wage. And economic justice is something that we never really talk about, and it's so important to this conversation of, like, how do we cultivate solidarity with one another? And so, you know, there is space, and because what happens sometimes also in our organizations is that they will hire, and not even hire, they'll ask a trans woman of color to come and give her expertise, her narrative, in order for them to kind of utilize her narrative and tokenize her narrative and use it for their own benefit, but they won't pay her for her work. And so I've had a lot of organizations ask me to work for free, and to be honest, like, it's not like I can't work for free.
Right.
I just cannot. And so I'm like, what resources can you leverage? And oftentimes they're not willing to leverage anything. And so it's like, if you can't pay me my fee, we can have conversations around other things, but oftentimes what it is that they want my free labor, and they want my narrative, and they want to say that they're working with me, but they actually are not. They're just using me.
Yeah.
And so I don't do it. I don't do it. And I think that what would happen if all trans people said they won't work for free?
Right. You are totally billing me for this radio interview, aren't you?
Well, I mean, like, I had the time, and I said this.
Well, but here's the fun part, because let me just say this, be very upfront about this. I want you to get booked. I like the part where you get bookings. And by the way, can we do better than shoot for more than living wage? I like the part where we shoot for, you know, a lot more money than just living wage. Although, yes, let's talk about economic justice, and that's a great place to start. But here's the thing. I want you to get booked. So to all of our listeners out there, I want you to do your pitch and say, look, this is why you should book Lady Dane, and this is what Lady Dane is going to do for you, for money, by the way.
They know why they should book Lady Dane. If they've been listening to the interview, it's very clear.
Exactly.
So that part I don't have to do. I mean, like, you should book me because I'm a black trans woman, period. Yeah.
Done.
And then also, I just want to be very clear. When I say living wage, I'm not, you know, it depends on what we consider a living wage. Right.
Right.
So, wink, wink.
I love it.
You know, when I say living wage, I think all of those things.
Yeah. Oh, so, absolutely.
Yeah, you know, book me. Of course, book me because, listen, book me.
Done. She's going to help you out, folks. She's going to entertain you. If you use the word allyship, she's going to very gently tell you why that word is not right and it will never be used again. I'm very excited about that. So you have so many projects going on right now. Where do we focus? What's coming up that you are super excited about?
What's coming up that two things.
Tell me.
I just dropped Wither, which is my novella, which takes place kind of in the same world as my novel Brew. And so, like, at the same time, and it's super, super, I'm really happy about the project. I'm really happy about it because it's about a witch who's into espionage in D.C., whereas Brew takes place and it's about a community of trans witches in Baltimore. And so I'm really happy to world build and create a whole world of witches, and what if, and this magical realism and Afrofuturism. And so I'm super excited about that. And then, you know, I'm the healing and wellness coordinator at Casa Ruby. And so I'm excited to bring us into the next, to be a part of bringing us into the next phase of our wholeness and our healing. I have some other things coming up. I curate La Tujo, celebrate trans artists every year. And so I'm really happy about this year because we're going to be having some trans artists from New York, from Jersey, come down, from D.C., from Baltimore, come down and perform for this evening of celebration of artists. And so I'm very, very excited about that in March. And then also I'm excited to literally wake up every day to breathe and to be able to exist in love space with my incredible community of people. But yeah,
There it is. I have to tell you, so I've been immersing myself in your work, and even just talking to you right now, I am so bowled over by your authenticity. It really, my hope is that you know that it really is an inspiration for everybody who's seen your work, everybody who's hearing you right now, just anybody you encounter. It really is just this stark and real authenticity that I think really role models what the rest of us should be doing.
You know, thank you. Thank you so much. I'm really honored to be able to be who I am and to be who I am within my authenticity and to be loved for who I am.
Oh, right? Yeah.
And so I really am, I will say this, I'm really privileged to be able to be who I am living at this time, loving the way that I do, being who I am, and all of that beauty and goddess lusciousness. So. Yeah. I'm really honored to be able to do that.
Well, we are honored to have you on the show. Listeners, you need to stroll on over to LadyDaneFE.com. We will certainly link to it, LadyDaneFE.com, because you're going to get all the most important links there, and you're going to learn about the books, and you're going to see videos, and there's upcoming, and there's roaring, and you can contact her. And the most important thing, folks, if you've been listening to even a word that Lady Dane has said, book her, because this is what you're going to get, and these are important conversations. Lady Dane, what an absolute honor to have you on this show. I'm so excited to see all the great things you're still going to do.
Oh, yes. I'm super excited. Oh, I did forget that I'm in talks right now with a theater in New York to produce a weekend of my one-woman show, Clytemnestra. So I am excited about that work, though, because that work deals with identity colonization and how do we work through that and how do we literally dig up the ghosts of our ancestors and give them rest and solace in their truth.
Oh, that's beautiful.
So, yeah.
Beautiful. And promise me one more time that you're taking the time to sleep.
I am.
Okay.
I'm definitely being better about that.
Okay. I want you healthy. I want you performing. I want you doing everything that it is that you do, because it really is a beautiful thing to behold. Lady Dane, what an absolute treat having you on the show. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, Ken. And it has been such a blessing and an honor. And I'm honored to be here to be able to share my story with all the folks out there. And so thank you.
You have to understand the way I am, mine hair. A tiger is a tiger, not a lamb, mine hair. You'll never turn the vinegar to jam, mine hair. So I do what I do. When I'm through, then I'm through, and I'm through. Toodaloo. Bye, bye, my liebe Herr. Farewell, my liebe Herr. It was a fine affair, but now it's over. And though I used to care, I need the open air. You're better off without me, mine hair. Don't dab your eye, mine hair, or wonder why, mine hair. I've always said that I was a rover. You mustn't knit your brow, you should have known by now. You've every cause to doubt me, mine hair. The continent of Europe is so wide, mine hair. Not only up and down, but side to side, mine hair. I couldn't ever cross it if I'd tried.
All right, folks, and we are back. Well, we have a ton of time left on this week's show to get to all of the latest LGBT news out there. We start with the great state of North Carolina. Three couples filed a lawsuit this week challenging North Carolina's law allowing officials to refuse to perform gay marriages based on their religious beliefs. Their attorney says that the state is violating the First Amendment and using taxpayer money to advance a religious point of view, and they want to strike down the law. It's one of only two of such laws in the country. The law was pushed by Republicans and passed in June over the veto of Republican Governor Pat McCrory. Under the law, local magistrates who can preside over marriages and some register of deeds officials who issue marriage licenses, they can opt out of performing marriages if they have a, quote, sincerely held religious objection It's quite the tricky phrase, sincerely held religious objection. There is, of course, no barometer for a sincerely held religious objection. There is no rubric by which we can determine if someone has a sincerely held religious objection. They just have to express one. Attorney Luke Largesse said that even if officials don't support gay marriage, they must uphold the law. He said this, quote, "People are entitled to have their religious beliefs about marriage, but the state can't pay for it." The plaintiffs were not present at this press conference, but this is what their attorney said at this news conference in Charlotte. Only North Carolina and Utah provide religious objection options for court officials. In North Carolina, any official's decision to opt out applies to all marriages, same-sex and heterosexuals, for at least 6 months. About 5% of the state's roughly 670 magistrates have filed recusal paperwork as of this past September, according to the state court system. I didn't even know all of this was going on. Backers of the law say that it protects religious freedom and that government employees should be allowed religious accommodation if marrying same-sex couples runs counter to their beliefs. The law's chief author, Senate Leader Phil Berger, he considers the law a reasonable solution. While complying with court rulings that ordered civil gay marriages be performed, he said this in a statement, quote, "Every North Carolinian seeking a gay marriage license since the bill became law has received one, and this is just the latest attempt by the far left's political correctness mob to force their beliefs on everyone else by trampling the First Amendment guarantee of religious freedom." End quote. The lawsuit focuses primarily on the magistrate exception, arguing that it treats gay and lesbian couples differently, which is in violation of the equal protection provision in the Constitution. The law also puts religious belief above the obligations of magistrates to carry out laws they swore to uphold. The law, quote, "does not represent the values of inclusion on which North Carolina was built." And that's a quote from Chris Segro, who is the executive director of Equality North Carolina. He continued by saying, quote, "it targets same-sex couples." So that is a lawsuit going on in North Carolina. Apparently only North Carolina and Utah, the only ones that allow these magistrates to opt out under the, quote, "sincerely held religious objection loophole." We're going to call it a loophole. I'm not even sure what else to call it, but there you go. Sincerely held religious objection. That's happening in North Carolina. In Jamaica, a Jamaican gay rights activist has brought a rare legal challenge to the Caribbean island's anti-sodomy law that criminalizes consensual sex between men. Gay rights campaigner and attorney Maurice Tomlinson filed a claim in Jamaica's Supreme Court challenging the constitutionality of the rarely used 1864 laws that ban anal sex and anything interpreted as, quote, "gross indecency between men." In a statement from the Canadian HIV/AIDS Legal Network, Tomlinson said, "Longstanding laws are a, quote, gross violation of my human rights." And he went on to say that it violates the rights of all LGBT people in Jamaica. He is a senior policy analyst with the Toronto-based advocacy organization. Tomlinson believes the laws infringe on a charter of human rights Jamaica adopted in 2011 that guarantees islanders the right to privacy, among other things. He asserts that the 151-year-old law hinders efforts to fight HIV in Jamaica while fueling homophobia and horrific violence. Another Jamaican gay rights activist, and we covered this a few years ago, made headlines in 2013 after initiating a similar constitutional court challenge to the anti-sodomy laws. But that activist, Javed Jagai, withdrew the case last year because of safety concerns. He was represented by Tomlinson, who filed this complaint. Homosexuality, just to let everybody know what Jamaica is like for our LGBT brothers and sisters, homosexuality is perceived as a sin by Jamaica's influential religious lobby, and nearly a dozen other Caribbean nations where anti-gay laws are on the books also consider it to be a sin. Many in Jamaica consider homosexuality to be wrong, and some insist violence against gays is blown out of proportion by homosexual activists. In a 2014 report, New York-based Human Rights Watch asserted that LGBT people in Jamaica are frequently refused housing or employment and remain the targets of unchecked violence. The high-profile 2013 mob murder of transgender teen Dwayne Jones outside of Montego Bay remains unsolved. Yet, Human Rights Watch noted a groundswell of change in the way Jamaica is responding to human rights abuses against LGBT people. Activists within the country's main gay rights groups say tolerance is clearly expanding on the island, even though stigma is still common and the laws criminalizing gay sex between men remain on the books. The Jamaica Forum of Lesbians, All Sexuals, and Gays held the island's first public gay pride celebration earlier this year, and the week-long observance was peaceful in the country, frequently portrayed by gay activists abroad is one of the globe's most hostile places to homosexuality. It is not clear when a first hearing in Tomlinson's challenge might be heard. So that is going on in Jamaica. Hopefully some progress there in Jamaica. In San Diego, I love this story. A local nonprofit is preparing to build San Diego's first low-income apartment complex geared for senior citizens who are gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender. When the 76-unit complex opens in North Park, San Diego will join Chicago, Philadelphia, Los Angeles, and San Francisco as cities that provide this type of housing. Such housing is considered crucial because members of the LGBT community often feel unwelcome in ordinary senior complexes, where the older residents tend to be less open to any type of alternative lifestyle. This is a quote from Dolores Jacobs, who's the chief executive of the San Diego LGBT Community Center. She said this, quote, "The people who live here pave the way for younger LGBT generations, and many of them are forced back into the closet in traditional senior communities because of a lack of acceptance." This is such an important project that will absolutely change lives. This is a $27 million complex. It's going to be open to all seniors, but the nonprofit building it, and the nonprofit's name is Community Housing Works, they plan to create a welcoming environment for LGBT seniors that will encourage them to move in, including on-site supportive services coordinated by the local LGBT community center. 87-year-old Robert Bettinger, who identifies as gay, said this, quote, "Many people are going to benefit from relief from isolation, depression, and anxiety, and find that moments in their last days can be full of compassion and warmth. I'm happy for the many people who will go forward in hope, safety, and comfort." Amazing quote. Amazing quote there. A 2013 Pew Research poll found that 50% of baby boomers consider homosexuality acceptable, compared to 63% among Generation X and 71% among millennials. San Diego City Councilman Todd Gloria said this, quote, "This project is a first step. Our goal must be that all senior housing options become open and affirming." The city council unanimously approved the complex this week, and they agreed to join with the San Diego Housing Commission to cover $7 million of its cost. The project also meets other city goals for low-income housing. Sue Reynolds, who is the nonprofit's chief executive, said this, quote, "This transit-oriented, pedestrian-friendly location in North Park means these seniors will be living in a cutting-edge infill development close to shopping, the new bus rapid transit, medical centers, and opposite a proposed 118-unit market-rate apartment complex." This is so exciting. The voice of our LGBT seniors needs so much amplification. And so any type of project that will make certainly their life safer, but more enjoyable and more fulfilling is one that will always get our vote. So kudos to everyone who's been working on this truly, truly important project. Very exciting stuff. In Ohio news, I love Ohio. I live here in Ohio. This is exciting Ohio news. Almost two dozen pastors and citizens packed Cincinnati council chambers just this week in an organized effort to stop a proposed city ban on so-called conversion therapy for gay youth. But in the end, the council voted 7-2 to pass the law, which prohibits therapy designed to change sexual orientation or gender identity for minors, and it imposes a $200 a day fine on violators. Cincinnati follows four states, California, Oregon, Illinois, and New Jersey, and the District of Columbia for banning the therapy. It becomes the first city outside of D.C. to ban conversion therapy. Cincinnati, Ohio, the first city outside of Washington, D.C. to ban conversion therapy. Councilman Chris Seelbach, who led the effort to bring the ban to the city, said this, quote, "This is about saving the lives of LGBT people." He spoke of Leela Alcorn, a transgender teenager who killed herself last December. Her suicide note cited the controversial therapy to which she had been subjected. The Councilman Seelbach said this, quote, "She challenged us to make her death matter, and we're doing just that." So Fantastic. Now, of course, there were opponents to this. As I said earlier, 21 people spoke out against the ban during council's comment period, decrying it as an assault on free speech and freedom of religion. Dr. Dan Farrell, a pastor, said this, quote, "I believe the city should stay out of this. It says something about you. Maybe other cities have better sense." Bishop Victor Cousins said this, quote, "This council will create another type of bondage for something people themselves have a right to seek liberty from." And Edward Hyde said this, quote, "I want government to stay out of the bedroom." No speakers identified themselves as conversion therapists. The lone person speaking on behalf of the law, John Bogus, the board chairman of Equality Ohio, countered those against the ban, saying, quote, "This is a matter of public safety." So I want to go back to the start of the story because we want to be very clear on this. So this reparative therapy, conversion therapy, by every single medical account, by every psychological account, by every reputable organization, this is not a therapy that works. And not only does it not work, but it actually does harm to the patient. So it doesn't work. It absolutely doesn't work. And it does harm. But the only states that have banned conversion therapy are California, Oregon, Illinois, and New Jersey. And the only places outside of California, Oregon, Illinois, and New Jersey that have banned conversion therapy are Washington, D.C., and now Cincinnati, Ohio. This is a therapy that does actual harm. It is harmful to the patients, and so often the patients are youth. So often they are LGBT younger brothers and sisters who are being forced into this situation. And the only places outside of California, Oregon, Illinois, and New Jersey that ban this really harmful practice are Cincinnati, Ohio, and Washington, D.C. If you are sitting there thinking, well, gosh, we're just doing so well. We're doing so well. We got that marriage equality. There is so much other work to do. We must not be complacent. We must not be complacent. And just to remind us that we must not be complacent, we have to go back to talking about Houston. One of the two candidates for mayor of Houston says discrimination against transgender people isn't common in the city, and that the now repealed Houston Equal Rights Ordinance, HERO, was, quote, entirely about the bathrooms. Bill King made the comments last week in his final debate with opponent Sylvester Turner. King and Turner face each other in a runoff election this coming week because no candidate received a majority of the vote on November 3rd. King said this, quote, "My problem with the ordinance always was that in the 9 months it was in place, we had a total of 11 complaints under it. We'll have that many robberies and burglaries in the city tonight during this debate. And if we're lucky, we'll solve one of those. This is a question about priorities. Like I said, getting back to basics, we need to focus on what's really important in the city. I don't think there was a single complaint, as I recall, about a transgender problem. So what problem are we trying to solve here?" And so he admits it was just all about the bathroom. So again, here's another area of LGBT life where there's so much support that's needed. This HERO, this Houston Equal Rights Ordinance, was soundly defeated there in Houston solely due to fear tactics, solely due to opponents using fear-mongering tactics that men are going to be in women's bathrooms. It was a gross misrepresentation. It preyed upon people's fears, and it worked. It absolutely works. So certainly more to do in Houston and everywhere where these equal rights ordinances do not live on the books where they most certainly should be living on the books. A federal judge still there in Houston, a federal judge has dismissed a lawsuit brought by conservative Houston area ministers against outgoing Mayor Anise Parker in an attempt to win damages and recover legal fees from an earlier suit. The Houston Area Pastor Council had alleged that Parker and her administration violated the group's constitutional rights by rejecting its petition to put the LGBT-inclusive Houston Equal Rights Ordinance before voters and by issuing subpoenas to some ministers seeking content of their sermons, as the city was building its defense in the previous suit, but the pastor's group failed to establish any constitutional violations and in any case does not have standing to sue. So there's also that part where they're not allowed to sue. As for the five named plaintiffs, they don't even live in Houston. They don't even live there. U.S. District Judge Vanessa Gilmore ruled this on December 1st. Ballot initiatives and referendums, Gilmore wrote in her dismissal order, quote, are mechanisms of direct democracy and are not compelled by the Constitution of the United States. Restrictions on referendum petitions do not implicate the federally protected right to vote. Also, by the way, let's remind people, they didn't even live in Houston. They had no right to sue. A lot going on in Houston. A lot going on in Houston. On the national campaign trail, Marco Rubio, he has again showed his true anti-LGBT colors in an interview with the Christian Broadcasting Network. He declared if elected, he would reverse President Obama's executive orders to stop religious business owners who contract with federal government from discriminating against gays, as well as orders on gender identity, and appoint conservative justices to the U.S. Supreme Court who oppose same-sex marriage and abortion. This is what he said, quote, this is from Marco Rubio. He told this to the Christian Broadcasting Network's David Brody in an interview on November 24th in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. He said this, quote, the executive orders would be to reverse the executive orders the president has made on things like gender equality in restrooms. You've seen some local districts and others been forced to provide girls access to a boy's bathroom and so forth. These sorts of things you've seen in Illinois, for example, but also ensure that we're not doing anything that in any part in our government that is putting organizations that are motivated by their faith or organized around their faith from having to violate the tenets of their faith, and that includes government contractors. That was all, by the way, one sentence from Marco Rubio. He went on to say this, quote, there are many government contractors and small companies who provide services to the government who are faith-based people, and they are being compelled to sin. They are being compelled to sin by government in their business conduct. This is not something we should be supporting. Marco Rubio told Brody his goal in this radio interview is to protect religious liberty in America. He said, quote, that includes reversing any administrative decisions made by this president that force religious or religious motivated entities. You may not be owned by a church, but you are a religious school, or your mission is to spread the gospel and adhere to God's teachings. Ensure that people in the private sector and the non-for-profit sector are being protected in living out of faith. End quote. Rubio also said that he will only nominate Supreme Court justices who believe that the court's ruling on marriage equality and abortion rights are, quote, constitutionally flawed. He said this about the Supreme Court system. He said, quote, I think one of the biggest things the next president is going to do is appoint justices to the Supreme Court, justices who understand that the Constitution is not a living and breathing document. It is a document of limitation, and it's supposed to be interpreted and applied based on its original intent. And there is no way that you can read that Constitution and deduce from it that there is constitutional right to an abortion or a constitutional right to marry someone of the same sex. And what you have is a Supreme Court that wanted to reach a certain policy outcome, and so creatively manipulated the Constitution to discover a right that for over two centuries some of the most brilliant minds in legal history didn't find. Gosh, it just indicates there, Marco Rubio, he has a fundamental and flawed interpretation of the Constitution and certainly of U.S. history, which even on the Republican side has interpreted the Constitution in ways that benefit all sorts of different groups of people. So to say that it's not a living and breathing document, that's just constitutionally inaccurate right there. Of course it is. Of course it is. You know, we don't have muskets anymore. We don't have institutionalized slavery anymore. The Constitution was written in a different time. Things are different. That's why there's amendments. That's why some amendments were repealed. Prohibition, you know, for those 2 weeks it lasted. So to say that the Constitution is not a living and breathing document, it's just bizarre, bizarre. In sports news, love this one, tennis superstar Martina Navratilova says the watershed movement for gay people in sports has been reached, and she is hoping for an avalanche. The tennis legend, who I adore, has written a piece for Sports Illustrated in which she commends basketball star Jason Collins for his coming out and how he has paved the way for future generations in sport. When the Brooklyn Nets player came out in 2013, he was the first active male athlete to do so from the four major North American professional teams. Since retiring, he has dedicated much of his time to campaigning on LGBT issues in sport. Navratilova wrote of Collins, quote, he is the proverbial game changer. One of the last bastions of homophobia has been challenged. She added, quote, Collins' actions will save lives. This is no exaggeration. Fully one-third of suicides among teenagers occur because of their sexuality. Martina Navratilova also mentions the group Athlete Ally, of which she is a member, along with a growing number of gay and straight athletes who are tackling the deep-rooted nature of homophobia and transphobia in sports by joining forces to raise awareness through campaigns and educational programming. The organization has even teamed up with the Ralph Lauren label to further raise awareness awareness, with A-list celebrities such as Uma Thurman, Robert De Niro, and Alan Cummings all showing their support. This level of support and visibility will help. Navratilova wrote this, quote, "Millions of kids will see that it is okay to be gay. No need for shame, no need for embarrassment, no need for hiding." And so she is hoping for an avalanche of out gay athletes. She encouraged this quote, come out wherever and whoever you are. It is beautiful out here, and I guarantee you this, you will never, ever want to go back. You will only wonder why it took so long. Love that. Love that Martina Navratilova. One of my favorites. One of my favorites. Last story. Starts out good, but then it doesn't do too well. Last year, over 39,000 people were diagnosed with HIV in the United States. That's a tremendous number, but for health officials, it's also encouraging. It means that the U.S. has experienced a 19% decline in the annual rate of HIV diagnoses over the course of the last decade. Unfortunately, though, the overall decline in HIV diagnoses also masks some alarming increases among gay men of color. The Center for Disease Control identified a 24% increase in new HIV diagnoses among gay Latino men between 2005 and 2014. This is according to data presented by the agency this past week at the National HIV Prevention Conference. There was a similar increase for black gay men, about 22%, but the new number of diagnoses leveled off after 2010, which may indicate that recent HIV interventions launched by the U.S. government are working. When the data was broken down by age, researchers also saw an 87% increase, in HIV diagnoses among black and Latino gay men between the ages of 13 and 24. This increase ended with a 2% decline in new diagnoses for young gay black men, however. So much work to do there. Black women, on the other hand, saw the largest decline in HIV diagnoses of any group. For them, the number of diagnoses was cut almost by half, going down to 4,600 diagnoses in 2014, which is down from 8,000 in 2005. Because HIV testing rates have been stable for gay Latino men since at least 2005, the Center for Disease Control thinks that the increase in diagnoses reflects an increase in infections. And that's a problem that the CDC doesn't yet understand. That's from Eugene McCrae, who is the director of the CDC's Division of HIV and AIDS Prevention. He said this, quote, "Is it because the prevention interventions are not just getting to the group in a way that's effective? We're going to be looking at that very carefully." So the CDC's announcement shows that although the U.S. is seeing some large improvements, preventative interventions deployed by health officials aren't reaching gay men of color with the same level of success. Right now, folks, there are 1.2 million people in the United States who are living with HIV. Health officials hope that new preventative measures, like the HIV preventative pill, Truvada, PrEP, will soon make an important dent in that number. McCrae concluded by saying this, quote, "We are now equipped with major prevention and treatment advances, so we know what works. Our challenge today is to make sure that everyone is benefiting." So, a lot more work to do there. Gosh, a lot of work to do, folks. Can't walk away from this week's episode without thinking, my gosh, there's a lot of work to do out there. And you play a part in doing that work. First and foremost, our huge, huge thanks to Lady Dane Figueroa Aditi. What an absolute treat to have her on the show. You have to be inspired by her words. You got to live your truth, everybody. You have to learn about your past, and you have to tell your story. That's what we're encouraging you to do. You guys, what you need to do is get out there and use your voice the way you know how to use it to make a difference for your LGBT and ally brothers and sisters. You know what you do best. You know how to most effectively use your voice, but you have to get out there and do it. You have to speak out against conversion therapy. You have to talk about what having a living wage means. You have to challenge someone when they say ally, because that's not really what we're going for. We want coalitions out there. Get out there, use your voice, make a difference. And hey, while you're out there using your voice, while you're out there making a difference, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?